Just to kind of quickly review or talk about what we talked about last week. Anybody get a chance to read the chapter this week?
I want to know how you find that on PDF or whatever you said you had it on.
What do you mean? An email.
I sent it out to you.
So you have to find where you got it.
I'll already send it to you. No, that's not.
He probably deleted it. Oh, John, man.
I already sent it to you.
Something for myself.
Yeah, something for myself.
Maybe we need four different ways to go.
Yes.
Okay,
Sean's going to forward it to you.
It's thick.
So you open up the email and you click on the download the PDF off the email and then you pull it up.
Well, this one comes, yeah, so it's not going
to work. You can print it up, print it off. I thought
it was on the website.
Hey, your service really is going to be bad now.
Just pay the bill.
Yes, they're going.
Oh, that's Jerry.
Down to dial-up
speed. He doesn't need dad.
See, we got to make the noise, too, with the dial-up.
Oh, yeah.
You know that noise you used to make?
Yeah, that little dude
running. I probably may not remember that.
Having a little guy run. He never got
there
anywhere fast.
I still remember, sending letters to people.
I don't remember.
That was long.
I remember life before cell phones.
Life before cell phones. You had to wait your turn in college to call your parents,
I didn't know that part.
You call your parents.
He wasn't
all right. Our topic of discussion is the modern day role of the pastor, minister, preacher in the church. And we talked last week about I asked some questions at the beginning of class about how, and we kind of came to the conclusion that the preacher, the minister, the pastor in the denominational world has become, it is the most identifiable person in a particular congregation, in a particular church. And it's not done that way necessarily by accident. I've had a lot of discussions this past week. Actually, Dad and I were talking just a couple days ago. We had a pretty long discussion about this, about churches in our immediate area who are struggling with finding a preacher or a minister. One steps down for this reason or that reason, and one of these churches. And again, I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just saying I know personally that one of these churches, they spent over a year searching for a preacher. It was a nationwide search for a preacher. They interviewed, I don't know, a lot of candidates. They had a lot of candidates come in and speak in front of the congregation and try out or whatever, and then go through a more extensive process and whatever. And one of these congregations, the one that I'm referring to, after this year-long search, they found the person exactly that they wanted, that they needed. Everybody pretty much was on board with him. They loved his preaching and his all this stuff, and he recently just up and resigned. After just, he'd been there, I don't know, a year or two. I don't know how long it's been, but not very long. They spent lots and lots of money, energy, effort, and were, I'm assuming, paying this guy a pretty good amount of money to be at this congregation. And for whatever reason, I don't know what happened, and I don't really want to know. I just know that that now he has stepped down. And now they're kind of in that up there, in a little bit of upheaval again. You know, the most congregations, if they don't have a preacher, it's almost like, walking out of the house without your pants. You just don't feel like sin. You feel like just something's not right. You feel kind of naked almost, if you don't have that minister to kind of put forward as that spokesman, as that liaison of your congregation, then you don't really know what to do. And we've talked about how when I know I, for me personally, when I mentioned that we don't, you know, we don't have a minister or preacher that, you know, that have, fulfills that role here, but we have a lot of different men that do that. And people just look at you like you're nuts. They just look at you like, what? Why would you do that? Why don't you want somebody, you know, to be that person in your congregation? But the whole thing is, and we talked about how in the early church, it was not that way. It was not a specific person within the congregation who led that church. That it was designed to be led, to be a very open leadership. You did have an eldership that were the shepherds that led the flock, that watched out for false teaching. And I guess fulfilled in some way some administrative responsibilities in some way. But for the most part, it was a very open, participatory environment, as we talked about in several of these chapters. And that people were encouraged to use the gifts that God had given them in the roles of speaking and in the roles in the New Testament prophecy and speaking in tongues and all those special gifts that were given, they were encouraged to use them. And it wasn't one person that came into the room and everybody, when he walks in, you know, everybody, you know, hushes down and it comes up to the front and everybody has some sort of a reverence for that person. We know that the attitude was totally opposite. Peter didn't want that. Paul didn't want that. And if anybody deserved to be revered in the church, Peter and Paul were those two people, right? They had, you know, they were apostles. They walked with Jesus. They had all these special, you know, but they didn't want that. And they tried to discourage it instead of encourage it. And last week we did kind of a brief summary of how it got to the point to where it was in the Middle Ages. It started out really, really innocently, right? It started out by just kind of elevating one person as the leader of the elders. And then it sort of gradually got to the point to where it was a very specific hierarchical system within the Catholic Church. That you had the Bishop of Rome, who was known as also the Pope, who kind of led everything. Everything went through him, and then he had his council, and then you had these bishops in all these different areas, and then he had his councils, and then they had all these different people within the church at that time, which was never intended. You had all these different, I think about it in this way too. Do you think our founding fathers ever thought that our government would be what it is now? Do you think it's what they intended? To have all these different, the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of this and the Department of, you know, picking your nose and the Department of anything that you can do, there's a department for it. Right? If there's any problems, oh, we'll just make a new department. You know, and we have all this hierarchical system to where, you know, there's so much red tape and so much stuff you have to cut through to actually get anything done. You think that's the way that it was intended to be? No, not at all. They would look back and they would look at it and say, what have you guys done to yourselves? And that's kind of the way the church was. You know, everything had, and the practices of the church no longer really went through the Bible. They went through the men who made the decisions, all the way up to the Pope. Let's spend just a couple minutes talking about some guys who tried to change. Some guys who tried to make some changes. And I'm in no way trying to downgrade or denigrate. Not that I'm going to offend them, because they're all dead. But I'm not trying to downgrade and denigrate these guys, because they were trying to do, I think, what was right. They were trying in their own mind to make some positive headway. And so some guys like Luther and Calvin and Bucer, and there were several other guys that I'll mention their names, Zwingli and all these different reformers, were part of the Catholic Church. And a lot of them were priests within the Catholic system. And they started thinking about it, they started looking at it, they started seeing the corruption that existed, which is always inherent in a hierarchical system, right? Where power is involved, there's always going to be corruption involved. Because people can get personal things out of the decisions that they make, right? That would never happen in our own government, right? Like we're talking about this hierarchical system, the more bureaucracies, the more committees, the more people you have in charge of stuff, the more corruption you're going to have. And within the church, it had gotten so corrupt and so off base that these guys, to their own detriment, they stood up, they stuck their neck out, literally, some of them. And some of them, when they stuck it out, they got chopped off. They got excommunicated. They got you know, people hated them. People tried to kill them. People, they were being tortured, and they were all this stuff for just putting forth the idea that, hey, we've come way farther than, we've come somewhere that we never, that the Bible never intended us to be. So they were looking at this idea of this hierarchical system, and they started thinking, well, you know, the Pope is not really biblical. The priesthood, as put forth in the Catholic Church, is really not biblical. And so they started thinking about these things. They started talking about these things. They started preaching these things and teaching these things to people. But the thing is, the one thing that they held on to throughout the whole process of this trying to reform the church was the idea that the ministry, the ordained minister, was something that was needed. They never got away from that idea. They believed that ministry was an institution that was for those who were called, or those who were ordained. So there was this special class of people within the church who they had this special responsibility that was given to them by God. Luther and these guys were a part of this class. These guys that were the informed, the ones that were the learned and all that. The reformers believed that only the ordained minister could preach, baptize, and minister the Lord's Supper. And they still, even in reformed churches, they still did ordination, like we talked about last week, the idea of giving a minister a special blessing. That then gave them the authority to be the spokesperson, the mouthpiece of the church. To where people then, well, he's an ordained minister, and so he has special responsibilities, and he has special a special pipeline to God. He's his voice, and there are lots of, if you read this chapter, there are lots of quotations from Luther and Calvin that talk about the fact they honestly thought that he was a channeling of God. Now, it wasn't any kind of magical thing, but it was the fact that he was the one that spent time studying and learning about God's Word, and so then he became the voice, the mouthpiece of God, to the point of not being able to question what he said. To the point of what he says is the truth, and you can't question it. Which, we understand, is not anything that should be ever talked about. Here's there's one quote in the book that says, Luther and the other reformers violently denounced the Anabaptists, which eventually became just known as Baptists, for practicing every member functioning of the church. The Anabaptists believed that it was every Christian's right to stand up and speak at a meeting. It was not solely the domain of the clergy. Luther was so opposed to this practice that he said it came from a pit of hell, and those who were guilty of it should be put to death. And this is Martin Luther. We look at this guy as somebody who is trying to get things back the way that God intended them to be in the New Testament. And yet something that's very plainly taught, and something that doesn't take a whole lot of study to figure out the way that the early church had this attitude of an open, participatory attitude in a meeting. He says it was from the pits of hell, and you should kill. And they actually did. They actually did kill a bunch of Anabaptists for believing this thing. Luther became exactly the thing that he hated within the Catholic Church. He then became his own law. He became his own ruler. And Calvin the same way. And he actually quotes that a little bit later in the book that I'll bring up in a second. He says that ordination was the key to having power in the church. And he was paid for this role. So still the idea of this guy being paid to be the guy within the church that performed baptism and did the preaching and did the serving of the Lord's Supper, which was done a lot differently, of course, in that period. The reformed minister was viewed by the church as a man of God. Now, is that idea still prevalent? That somehow the preacher of the congregation, or the minister, or the pastor in the denominational world is still seen as, you know, somehow a little bit better spiritually or religiously than anybody else. Because he's dedicated and devoted himself, he's ordained his life and given it to a special calling in ministry. We still see that attitude, don't we? In a very real way. And I'm telling you this, it does not matter if you say, even in the Church of Christ, that we do not see that view, you're just fooling yourself. Most places, most people see the minister as some sort of a special set-aside. And again, it's not necessarily that the minister desires that. It's not that really that. It's that he's seen as something special. He's seen as a class above just the regular member. Have you ever made that statement in your life? Well, I'm just a regular member. You ever made that statement? Well, what are they looking at me to do something for? I'm just a regular member. Well, in God's church, there are no regular members and special members. We're all members of the body, right? And he's very clear, and Dad brought this up in his sermon last week, he's very clear about that if every member does not function properly, what happens? The body will not function properly. And I think that's the point to where, I think that's the point to where the church is. And I don't know that we've ever gotten to the point to where the members function as they should, where the body functions properly. Look at the church and see how basically ineffective we've been in the world, and you'll see that maybe we're not functioning like we should.
Yes, because that philosophy helps us feel better about the fact that, oh, that's not my job. That's not something I should be doing. He's the guy. That's what he's supposed to be doing. So therefore, I can feel better about my inactivity because I'm paying him to be active. It's a philosophy that's ingrained in us from the beginning. Mm-hmm. If you realize that you are the church, you are the person, and it's not getting done, then who's not doing it? It's a lot easier to complain. The deacons aren't doing their work. The elders aren't doing their work. The preacher's not doing, the church isn't growing. When in reality, I'm not doing what I should do, so therefore the church isn't growing. If we put him on a pedestal, then we are comfortable where we're at. Because there's the person we all look to and say, fails. If it goes good, he gets the credit. If it fails, he gets the credit. I'm safe. I don't have to do anything. This whole position is there for a reason. Because the people want it that way. In my opinion.
I think that's very true. And we have created a
system.
That's a very funny word. A hierarchical system within the church that was not intended. We call them the proper names, right? Elders, deacons, ministers. We use that word, and we call that special person that we set aside. We call them a minister. We're very careful not to call them a pastor because it goes against the biblical role of the pastor, right? But we set up this hierarchical system to where, in all honesty, who is the representative of the church? Is it the elders? No. Most congregate, well, I don't know if this is true or not. To the people, the minister is seen as that person, that liaison, that especially in the denominational world, maybe not so much within the church, but seen as that liaison, that person that is the representative of the church. I remember we were studying at another congregation that I was at, which pretty much narrows it down. We were at that congregation, and I asked in class, I would like for you to, at the time, I think we had 8 elders. I'd like for you to name our elders. In our class, we only named 2 of them. 2 of our elders, our class even knew. Now, at the time, they were older men, and I guess our kids just didn't have a lot of interaction with them. We had several new kids.
Don't feel bad. Shortly after you do that, when you mentioned it,
I asked the adult class that I taught. They could name five. Okay, so the teenagers at least are insulated a little more from them. You would think maybe they don't know the older guys. Their parents and their grandparents should know every one of them.
And I specifically remember the time when I was in a meeting with men there, and I told them that. You should have seen the looks on their faces. They were totally shocked that nobody knew that they were an elder of the congregation. And so at that point, a couple of them started trickling into the teen class to get to know the teens. Well, you know, then that quit after all. Within a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, you know, because it's. But the point is, you ask, who's the preacher of the church? Well, everybody knows the preacher. Why does everybody know the preacher? He's up in front of them every week, preaching. And he's doing the Sunday school class, and he's doing the devotional on Wednesday night before Bible class. And if there's a funeral, who's preaching the funeral? The minister is. If there's a wedding, who's usually doing the wedding? The minister is. And so the minister is up in front and in right in people's faces all the time. Elders, not so much. And I'm not saying that an elder needs to stand up and be, you know, well known in order to do a good job as an elder. But the point is that this hierarchical system, you have the preachers and you have the elders, and then you have the deacons who the elders appoint, and then you have the regular members. Is that the way that was intended? Was a deacon supposed to be elevated above everybody else? The word deacon means what?
Servant.
The word minister means what? It comes from the same word as it's diakonos. It comes from the word servant. And so, an elder is perceived as what? A servant or shepherd, right? Someone who's not necessarily elevated. I don't think the shepherd. He walks into the marketplace. He goes, "Ooh, here's the shepherd. That's all about him." The shepherd. No, the shepherd was somebody who probably had dirty hands. Who spent time with sheep all the time. Smell. He had like, you know, sometimes Jeff will come in. He'll have dog hair on his coat because he has two big old dogs that he loves to spend time with, right? You know, because it. That's just the way it is. I do the same.
But, and the dogs want to spend time with him.
But his hair sheds all over me.
Yeah. See, that's the other side of it. He wants to spend time with the dogs, but the dogs want to spend time with him.
Well, they like him a lot better.
And I think we have detached that where the elders want to do that, but the flock doesn't want to spend any time with the shepherd.
I'm so glad you said that, because this may sound busy. But most of y'all know we have two little goats that we got about 6 months ago, and we raised them from when they were 24 hours old. And most people don't raise sheep and goats in our normal society.
I'm not normal.
But one day I was sitting out there, I absolutely adored them. They are the sweetest things in the world. But it's the most unbelievable thing, the relationship you gain when you raise that type of animal, that type, you know, a sheep or a goat. Listen, they are on your heels everywhere you go. If you go too far away, they cry. And then they run as fast as they can to come to you. And if you stick your head outside the door, they cry. If you, you know, they run to the fence. And I had this just like, this is what it means. This is why they don't use another, like, camels. You know, they didn't talk about camels. You know, they talked about sheep and shepherds. And it's the most neat relationship when you raise and have that kind of animal, because they are just, you know, they're not like dogs. Dogs kind of run off, you know, or catch whatever. Not them. I mean, they are on you, and they look towards you as, you know, if they get scared, they run straight to me. And it's the most, I don't know, I know exactly why they use that, you know, that in the Bible, because it's a sweet, sweet relationship, because they're gentle animals, and they run right to you, and they do their little cry, and it's just, I don't know, I'm so blessed to have gotten to see what that really
means. And not particularly smart, either.
No.
They themselves into some very bad
No. They don't pay attention to anything.
They need someone.
And that's a great, you know, that's a great analogy for, you know, for us. Because, we, you know, a lot of times we're not very smart. We get ourselves into situations that we don't intend to. And we need help from people who are a little wiser, a little older, to help us to get out of these particular situations, and somebody we can go to that we feel comfortable with. Who are these kids going to go to talk to one, to our, to an elder or to a shepherd in the congregation that didn't even know who they were? Who would they go to? Well, they went to Jeff. They went to Mr. Judge. And they went to, you know, Randy Wilson, and they went to all these different people. They weren't elders particularly. They were men in their life who had made a difference, and they knew they could go to them. They were to them, not in the official biblical sense, but they were to them shepherds. Right? And so, that's pretty scary, by the way. But anyway.
But you're still alive.
But there's still alive. There's still alive.
But I like to take one.
I will say this about when you say that people's two of their biggest influences in their life were Dick Break and Mike Judge. You know,
that's scary.
Yeah, that's a, but anyway. The thing about, and this is a little bit off, a little bit aside though, the thing about those two guys and others in a person's life is they're not afraid to tell you when you're wrong. And in no certain terms are they afraid to tell you, dude, you are going down the wrong path. Right, Sean? You're going down the wrong path, and you need to change it quick.
I never went down the wrong path.
Never. Never.
You were a good child.
Were you rather on the right path? That's the question.
I was on my own path.
And therefore, in his mind, it's not wrong.
That's true. Okay. And I didn't really mean to get on the idea of you know, the purpose of elders. I think that comes up a little later. But the idea of the separation between special members, elders, ministers, deacons, and regular members, that never existed within the early church and was never intended to exist. Paul and Peter just wanted to be one of the group. They wanted to be somebody that was considered a brother in Christ. Paul never refers to... Jesus called a lot of times when he was preaching and teaching, he would call them my little children, right? He would call them children. Paul and Peter, they didn't treat people like that, did they? What did they always say? My brothers, my sisters. The equal plane of an idea of being my brother. The only one he calls his son in the faith is Timothy, and it was because he was so much younger, right? And he had developed a father, kind of a father-son relationship with Timothy. But the others, it's that vertical relationship that's on an equal plane. Now, he had a different role to fulfill, no doubt about it. But he didn't let it go to his head like he was supposed to be above everybody else. But that is what we've allowed, not we, that's what has been allowed, for that one person, that pastor, that minister, that preacher, to be that one person that represents the church. You know, and we talked about this when Rich was talking about the sermon. But it became the duty, became the ultimate responsibility of this minister and this pastor to become the one that preached. You know, in the early... let me see if I can find this real quick. It says, for all the reformers, the primary function of the minister was preaching. The preeminent place of preaching is best reflected in Luther's German Mass, which included three services on Sunday. I think we got that. 5 or 6 a.m. That's a good time. Want to start that, Jeff?
No.
A sermon was given on the epistle of the day. Imagine the 5 o'clock. Imagine the 5 a.m. service, the preaching during the 5 a.m. service. Goodness gracious. Hopefully that guy had a little bit of energy. A sermon was given on the epistle of the day. At the main service at 8 or 9 a.m., the minister preached on the gospel of the day. The sermon at the Vesper service, the evening service, was based on the Old Testament. 3 sermons a day. And these sermons were not 30-minute sermons. Sometimes they were an hour or 2 hours. And it was the responsibility of the minister to prepare and to preach. It was his job. He was the one that was looked to. And there is absolutely no doubt. But Luther also was the one that made... He said the Christian congregation should never assemble unless God's word is preached and prayer is made, no matter for how brief a time this may be. You know, I have heard, or I have, isn't it implied that anytime we have a service, it has to be preaching? Is that not implied? Sometimes it's said, but it's not. It is something that has become so ingrained in us. Is that from the Bible or is it not from the Bible? Well, really up until this point, you know, it wasn't really emphasized that much until Luther started kind of emphasizing that it didn't matter if you came together for a birthday party. If the church came together, you're going to have a sermon. You know, so people just avoided people's birthday parties. I don't know. You know, if we came together to watch Once Upon a Time, we'd have to pause at the beginning. Okay, and we have a little sermon before we start. You know, it was emphasized that any time we came together, the preeminent reason for coming together is for to be preached, for there to be preaching. Now, I'm not downplaying the idea of learning and of having lessons taught and of preaching. I'm not trying to downplay it. But what I'm saying is that what we've always, I think what we teach is, and what we think is sometimes that it's a biblical idea, that every time the early church came together, there was preaching. I don't think there's any proof of that. I don't think there's any way you could ever prove that. It came from the Reformers, the idea that the preacher was the one that was preeminent. Let me bring up just a couple more things. He talks about... Calvin and Luther, and this, I'm just going to briefly mention this, but they kind of emphasized the idea of the minister becoming, they called it, the curer of souls. That it became his job to visit the sick, and it became his job to visit those that were hurting, those that needed counseling, those that had other issues. It became the role of the minister, the pastor, the preacher, to go to that person and to be that person that goes to them and talks and tries to get them through those difficult times that they're having. And that has not changed, has it? That has not changed. There are lots of congregations that are kind of waking up to this idea, lots of elderships waking up to this idea that it's more of their responsibility to be this person that goes to people and talks to them, as the shepherd, as the one. But really, most people feel more comfortable with the preacher, right? They feel more comfortable with the preacher. I specifically remember. Now, I remember other times too. I remember times when, you know, when my first week on the job. This is literally my first week as a youth minister. Sellers was out of town. And I think he'd gone overseas for a mission trip or something. And, you know, I was clueless. I had no idea what I was doing. You know, I was just trying to make things work, trying to do whatever. You know, I just played a lot of basketball, strong. You know, that was pretty much fine. You know, what we did, right, Sean? Just hanging out with the youth, you know. I got a call, like, first or second week from one of the families at church. I had actually gone to high school with this girl. I didn't really know her that well. She was 2 or 3 years older than me. Her mother was on her deathbed. Guess who they asked to come? Me. You talk about a nervous puppy now. I've never been in that position. I'm not a hospital visitor. I've never been good at it. I always would just kind of fall behind sellers, you know, and just stand there, and then I just kind of fall back out, unless I knew the person. But I didn't know them. And they didn't know me. But I was the next best thing to the minister. I was the youth minister. Okay, minister wasn't available, so they went down the list. So a little bit lower,
second string.
And so, I went into this room. The lady literally was dying. When I walked in the room, where's the pressure lie in that situation?
Say something.
Everybody's looking at me. I don't even know the lady. I hardly know the family. And they don't know me. All they know is that some church hired me 2 weeks ago to come in and to be a minister.
So therefore you have a special connection to God.
I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I was, I, And I really laid it on Sellers when he came back. You know, why did you put me in that position? No. But everybody, it was literally, I walk in the room, she has just died, and everybody goes, looks at me. I didn't know what I was supposed to do.
Oh, sorry, wrong room.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Why did I think of that? Okay. So here we are, and everybody's looking at me, let us pray. And so I talk about this lady who I don't know. And, you know, I say whatever I can think of to say to try to comfort the family. My question is, why was it me? Why was it not eight elders in the room? Or people from the congregation that they knew? Or other people who had been... They didn't know me at all. I was a minister, and so therefore I qualified to step into that situation. I've done funerals with people. I have no clue who they are.
We're here to mourn the loss of Billy.
You know, I didn't know the guy. But because of a minister, I qualified to do a funeral of somebody I didn't know. To preach him into heaven. You know, I don't know why we've come to that and why we've stayed with that.
There's the key
idea.
I know why we got to that point.
Why we stayed with it.
Why did we stay with it? In a time when Bibles were more expensive than gold, and the only people that had them were in the building of the church. The common person couldn't have one or ever see one. They needed someone to tell them what it was. But from 1611 on, when it was in the common language and the printing press was developed, and most of us have five or six in our house that we can't even find, why do we still hold to the fact that somebody has to teach me what I can read for myself and what I can do for myself? And why do not, I put someone else on a place to isolate me from God?
And it's not so much teaching as just that they are the authority in teaching. That they are the authority in preaching. That what they say goes because they have a lot more knowledge and a lot more college training. And they have a lot, when we talked about all the attitudes that come around the idea of, I'm sorry, but I've heard preachers who have tons of college training that I don't care what they say. It affects me in no way. This guy, this big name preacher came to Harding my freshman year, and I went to the college church for the meeting, and I stayed one night. This guy, I mean, they had said he is the preeminent, you know, they didn't say preeminent, but you know, he is the guy, you know. And I went there and I was just like, and I could not even stay awake. And what he said, I was just like, I can get that myself. So I didn't waste my time by going back. So, you know, all the knowledge and all the training and all the college level whatever in the world does not make a person not only the authority, but it doesn't make them somebody that I actually want to listen to. Now, I want to make just a couple of points before we quit. He ends up the chapter with, how has this idea damaged the church? Do you believe it has?
Oh, yes.
I think we forgot our roots.
Okay.
If you look at the people who are the best, the ones who everybody looked towards, they were not anything educated. They were fishermen and tax collectors, and people that were looked down upon by the rest of society. But then, all of a sudden, they think, oh my gosh, these are educated men, but yet they're not trained. How in the world did they get this point?
Yeah, that was and they did. They brought that up, right?
Yeah.
How would this fisherman know anything? How does this tax collector? How do these guys that they've not been to the Christian schools, and they've not been to the, you know, they have Christian school, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They've not been to the, you know, synagogue training and all this. Okay, so definitely we have forgotten kind of our roots and kind of how things started within the early church. He brings up three points that I just want to mention briefly. The first one is the idea of the split between the little bit higher above Christian and the lower Christian. And within the church, this has, it's not the same as it is most places, right? I mean, it is not to the point to where, you know, you look at the denominational world, or you look at the Catholic Church, or you look at Lutheran or Methodist, all these different groups. The minister is the guy. He even wears different clothes, right? He wears, he puts on his robe before he goes out in most places. Or if it's not his robe, it's, you know, the Church of Christ robe, you know, suit and tie. He's got to have the suit and tie.
You know, you can't get up in the pulpit.
You can't get up in the pulpit without the suit. I'm not bashing people who wear suit and tie necessarily.
Even though you're the only one.
Just ones that don't match. Oh, it does match. Normally he doesn't.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so the idea of the split between the two, it keeps being permeated by the idea that there has to be a person that preaches and teaches, and this guy has to have certain, qualifications in order to meet that particular role. That will always exist as long as we elevate that minister, that preacher to that level. It will always exist. Number two, the modern day pastoral office has overthrown the main thrust of the letter to the Hebrews, the ending of the old priesthood. The idea that we both have, that each member has the right and the privilege to be a part of the leadership of the church, to be a part of what goes on, to be a part of being a minister within the congregation.
Yeah, 1 Peter 2 says the same thing. You are the royal priesthood.
Right. 1 Peter 2 and also 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, it talks about the idea of us being a royal priesthood, that all of us are priests, that we all have not only one-on-one relationship with God, but we also have that relationship with each other, and there shouldn't be any of us that are elevated above the other. Each congregation has a priesthood, but we have to have a high priest, right? Somebody who leads the priests.
Well, we have one.
It's not the way that it was talked about. That's right. We don't have a human high priest. Christ is our high priest. And that's the third point that he makes, is that we diminish the idea of what Christ's role is within the church, that he is the head of the church. He is the high priest. He is the one that we follow. It's his example that leads us, not the example of one person that supposedly is his mouthpiece to the church. How dangerous is that? How dangerous is that in any congregation when that one person is the authority on everything?
You drink the Kool-Aid.
Okay? Yeah, ask the Jim Jones people. Yeah, it's pretty dangerous. And some people have that power, and they like Luther, and he uses it, quote unquote, for good, right? Well, I'm only doing it for good. Well, did he end up being for good? Not so much. He's killing people too that disagree with him. So that idea of the separation between the two, of elevating that one person, is a very dangerous place. And a lot of people are there.
Well, Dave, I tell you, this may be the wrong time of class to bring it up right here at the end. But not being able to develop the gifts that God gives us, that's one of the byproducts of all this. Nobody can lead you into a cult if you're developing the gifts God gave you. Nobody can lead you down a different path if you're developing the gifts God gave you. Now, if you're not, and you're allowing someone else to develop them and to lead you around, then absolutely. But what I think we lose in a lot of this is our own individual spirituality and our own growing and developing of the gifts God gives us.
That sense of responsibility.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at Romans, and it talks about, you know, the five gifts of speaking, and everybody has it. Not one person does not have one of those five gifts. Now, what we all do with each one of them are different, but everyone has it. So allowing someone else to develop their gifts at the expense of our own personal responsibility, I think that's one of my greatest fears, is making sure that we continue to develop the gifts that God's given everyone in this room, not just special people.
I had a similar experience at Harding. I was a youth ministry major at Harding, and a lot of people...
You're kidding.
Yeah. A lot of people were mad because I was a woman, and they thought, like, I was going to be like, well, I am a woman.
I was going to ask that, but I don't know.
I was going to say, too. I'm going to clarify, that is not
Jared,
I
was proud of him.
I had to live with
him.
A lot of people thought I was wanting to be like a preacher, you know, which, no, I wanted to be. Growing up, we had a youth minister's wife who pretty much changed our life because of how involved she was in our life. And we saw a need for that, and so we both pursued youth ministry to pursue that same kind of mentorship role. And we were very involved in this church, and they refused to let us get involved with the youth group. We asked over and over, and we're like, we don't want money. We don't want any, we're not into that. Like, we don't care. We just want to get involved. And we're like, we're youth ministry majors, look, you know, and they're like, no. And they refused to let us. And then finally, like, when we got into grad school, there was a church in downtown that was, like, very much trying to get more people involved. And they let us, you know, be involved with teens. And we were able to I found it very fulfilling. In my youth ministry degree, like, nobody would let me use it. So it was like, I got caught up in the, all we were seeing were the politics of the church and, you know, the academia of it. We were like, where has this gone? Like, this ministry is gone.
Where did the church ever get to the point that they can tell someone, you can't do that?
I know. Yeah. That's
or funny. That we got to a point that we allow someone to tell us, you can't do that.
They told us when we were there, like, oh, we need help with kids. Why don't you go with the little kids? And, like, kids are precious. Not my gift.
Or if we married a chief minister, then we automatically got gifts.
Exactly.
That we could use.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, then you became acceptable.
Yeah, you're okay.
Then,
again.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you got the handbook and you read the handbook.
But it's been written over many, many years. As I see the early church, each one of them saw the need. They took care of the need.
Right.
They didn't have to ask, can I go do this? They did it. And there's no one there that can say, no, you can't work with the kids, because you know what? They're there. If you interact with them, you're working with the kids.
Well, the lies when they were having trouble fulfilling the duties that they needed to fulfill, the apostles, you know, they in their wisdom they said, you know, let's delegate this stuff.
Y'all figure it out
who can handle it and who does handle it. And I don't imagine they were, you know, they came up with a list of rules of who had to visit and who did this and how much food they gave. And you know, I think you guys, you know, you're competent individuals. You have gifts. Handle it.
I know it's time to quit, but in the early church, when Paul was writing to the Corinthians, they had that preacher-itis, you call it that. And they were paying more attention to what the preacher's tone of voice was, or their personality, all these things, and they divided themselves up, following men.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul says, our teaching is not like Plato or these guys that got off over here and invented their own philosophy that sounded good to a certain group of people, and all the people flocked to them because of, we all preaching the same thing here. We're all preaching Christ and Him crucified. You're dividing yourselves up by personality, by hierarchical judgment, standard. And he said, unless you get a spiritual mind, unless you start thinking on a spiritual way about who you are, what Christ has brought you into, you'll never solve all these problems that you have. And he goes, of course, on through the book, and they had so many problems, but it all went back to their mindset. They were not Christians in the sense that we've been talking about. They weren't connected personally to Christ and His headship and didn't feel that responsibility.
Same reason why congregations lose people when a minister leaves.
When you elevate a person to
it's
position,
preacher worship, it's
you immediately have 50% of the people that don't like them and 50% that do. It may be 60-40 some places. But immediately, if that person's always in the pulpit, there's 50% of the people when he gets up to speak are going, yes, and 50% are going, oh. Okay? Doesn't matter. It's all about personality, style, you know, whatever the case is. That's why, you know, when a preacher does leave, and it causes a lot of upheaval and a lot of problems within the church, and usually a split, or people leave, or whatever the case is. So the danger is definitely there, and I think we are moving in a different direction with this. And Jeff was talking about using your gifts, and Jeff definitely has a lot of gifts. Some of them awesome, some negative, but he has some gifts, and one of those gifts is administration. He definitely has a gift of administration of of leadership in that way.
Delegation.
And delegation, but
part of being a
I would say that at other congregations, Jeff wouldn't be given the opportunity to be a part of the leadership administrative aspects of the congregation. He couldn't be an elder because at this point he doesn't have children, so he couldn't be appointed an elder or deacon, so he probably wouldn't be given the responsibility.
Gotcha.
And so Jeff uses his gifts for work, but then he just doesn't use them in the church. And that should not be the case. We all have gifts that we use everywhere we go, and we need to be used not only, you know, in that part of our lives, but also within the church. And it should be encouraged, not discouraged. And that's, you know, that's definitely a danger with this. All right, we got to quit because we're way over time. Chris has one more comment. Chris, you can make it when you have to get upstairs.
Jake knows the one that finishes the pity pad on the feet upstairs.
Yeah.